The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. I was in the archives just the other day, come across this interview with Anthony Bourdain, author of his brand new book at the time, A Cook's Tour. Anthony, welcome.
Hi. All right, now, A Cook's Tour and Kitchen Confidential, pretty much both the same kind of book where you're traveling a lot.
Well, certainly the tone, the point of view is the same. I mean, it's called A Cook's Tour because it's very much a very lucky cook given the opportunity, largely actually on the strength of Kitchen Confidential, to, you know, eat my way around the world. And so essentially the point of view and I guess the tone are similar to Kitchen Confidential.
Now, you mentioned before the interview that you just loved, you just had fun writing this book.
Sure. I mean, it was an incredible score for me. It's the dream assignment. You know, I wrote up a wish list of cool places I wanted to go and cool things I wanted to do and things that I wanted to eat and try. And yeah, people were silly enough to give me money to do that.
Vietnam. I mean, pretty much you start off in Vietnam.
Yeah. It's a dream come true. I'd only seen it in films and newsreels and read about it. It was one of the few places where it absolutely lived up to my most movie-fueled hopes and expectations.
Now, you're looking for the best meal on every continent or every country. What are you doing?
You know, it's called In Search of the Perfect Meal. Frankly, that was a pretext. I mean, I wanted to leave myself open to both tragicomic disaster and happy magical accident. And essentially eat anything that came my way. I mean, I'm a good guest. So if a humble rice farmer comes at me with a steaming plate of the local favorite, the local specialty, I will always try it. And so I ate without fear or prejudice pretty much anything that crossed my path.
I read where your wife said that she would divorce you if you took a poor little monkey and cracked its head open and ate the brain.
Yeah, live monkey brain. Is that, you know, is that food or is that some weird male bonding thing? I mean, I made sure to not have that cross my path. That's something I avoided. And I'm very grateful that neither dog nor cat came my way. I certainly didn't go looking.
But you would have. I mean, if it would have been there.
Oh, I'm a cat owner, and that really would have been tough because I made a real point to not sneer. You know, I dropped into whatever culture enthusiastically and often boobishly. I mean, meaning I knew very little about what to expect in many cases. But I always took it as it came. And people were often people with very little were enormously kind and generous and proud of whatever it was they were serving. And most times that was resulted in a great meal. I'm just awful glad that that didn't come up in particular.
Okay, now on A Cook's Tour, I mean, I've done something here similar to what you've done. You're a city boy.
Oh, yeah, very much so. New Yorker, and, you know, have barely been out of New York until a couple of years ago.
Okay, I really wasn't from the country. Married a lady who lived on a farm, raised pigs, and to kill one, you describe the killing pretty good in your book. Mm-hmm. Now, they burned the hair off with straw, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, now what we did, we took boiling water and we had to scrape it off, which I think was even more disgusting than just burning it.
Well, as you say, I'm a city boy, and I've been, you know, a lot of hypocrisy here. I've been a chef and a cook for 28 years, and I describe in the book, I describe myself as kind of like Michael Corleone in Godfather 2. You know, I pick up the phone, and somewhere, someplace far away, something dies, and what arrives in my kitchen is inarguably meat, not a living thing, or even, you know, obviously a formerly living thing. Well, when you want fresh meat or poultry in much of the world, in fact, in most of the world, something very visibly dies. And I attended a medieval pig slaughter in Portugal. This is a a cherished celebration all across Europe and much of the world. In fact, the whole village turns out, kids, it's a happy event. I, of course, found it very violent and disturbing. But then again, I probably would be upset seeing a cow milked. So, you know, it took some getting past, but it made me have a deeper understanding of the real cost of dinner.
You know, when I would meet a pig, I would meet a cow that was soon to be slaughtered. It's a little tough to eat that, I think. Is that how you felt also, or?
No, I had a very hard time, you know, watching an animal hurt or killed, of course. But you know, once there comes a point where life leaves and it becomes food, I can make that distinction. The guilt didn't carry over. In a sense, it did. I mean, I think that a slight sense of shame and culpability should be part of the dining experience. You should know where your food comes from, and you should respect that a life oftentimes was shed for this meal. I think you will both eat better in that case and hopefully be a better person.
Although, as a chef yourself, I mean, you've taken live lobsters and dunked them in some...
Yeah, well, they're, you know, a lobster's too dumb to know it's dead. You know, it doesn't get the message till long after. That's a big bug.
Okay. So, on your tour of the world, your world tour,
mm-hmm.
It almost sounds like you're a rock and roll star. what is some of the most disgusting things you've ever eaten?
Undercooked boiled iguana, I would not recommend to anyone. I love everything about Japanese food and Japan, with the exception of natto, the beloved breakfast staple of the Japanese. It's fermented soybeans. I found that really appalling. I'm sure, you know, what's going to get the most play in the press and has been is I ate the live, still-beating heart of a cobra in Saigon. I wish I could say that that was even in the top 10 worst things I had. It wasn't even close.
Really?
Yeah. And let's see. Oh, you know, I've had tree grubs, crickets, tête de veau, which is, you know, a French classic. I mean, a lot of stuff that sounds really, you know, awful was actually quite good. You know, I went out in the Sahara with some Tuareg tribesmen, and we roasted a whole lamb. And, you know, sheep's testicles I can recommend as, you know, quite delicious. If I disguised them with a little sauce and called them something like pavé, d'agneau, Maroc, and served them in my restaurant, everyone would love them. It's a matter of marketing. And in fact, I found that a lot of the neglected parts and less glamorous foodstuffs that a lot of the rest of the world has taken to heart and that we sort of sneer at are in fact the best. You know, those shoulders and shanks and root vegetables can be the best parts.
Now, in your book, you talk about the French, and they are considered great culinary experts.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, way back, they were such a poor country, they had to learn to take everything from a carcass?
Well, I think that the reason that the French and France and Italy, for instance, are great mother cuisines is because they had to become great mother cuisines. They, you know, all of the techniques that they developed over time were answers or solutions to very real problems of no money, no refrigeration, very little raw ingredient. They needed to preserve food or flavor it to overcome deficiencies, to find ways to cook tough pieces of meat, to make the most of what they had, and to make the most of what they had in each particular region and in each particular season. And over time, well, that is almost always the engine, necessity, poverty. These are always the engines that drive cultures to develop great cuisines. And you see that on the ground happening in Vietnam, very much in Vietnam, where, you know, everything is good.
Now, you started out as a chef. I'm sure you studied someplace. Where did you study?
Well, I started out as a dishwasher and worked my way up the line and then got serious about the business and went to the Culinary Institute of America, where I learned just enough to become annoying. And, you know, just slowly over time, like a lot of other people in the business, you know, kind of clawed my way up to the top and hung on. And I've been a chef for almost 30 years now.
You know, you're a head chef someplace, or do you own a restaurant?
I'm an executive chef of a Brasserie Leal in Manhattan, and what that means lately is I put on a chef's coat and swan around the dining room and take credit for others' work. But until very recently, it meant I worked on the line every single day and hung around at night expediting and ordering and essentially leading a crew of badly behaved but ruthlessly efficient pirates.
Now, you know, a lot of people would say, man, this is so exciting, but I don't know that you're that excited about being on the Food Network. You know, it's just a little...
It's a devil's bargain. I mean, I'm proud of the show. I'm just as unpleasant on camera as I am off. When I'm happy, I look happy on the show. When I'm miserable, I look miserable. So it's unlike anything else on the network. But yeah, I mean, I have mixed... Traditionally, TV chefs are a little too cuddly and adorable and happy for my taste. But, you know, I hope to be part of the solution.
Okay, because I've met a few of them from the Food Network.
Mm-hmm.
The few that I've met, they seem like great guys.
Mm-hmm.
Emeril Lagasse, though, I've seen him on some different game shows.
Yeah.
He just doesn't strike me as being the most...
Actually, I'm told he's a really, off camera, I'm told he's a really sweet, nice, quiet guy who cooks well, has some good restaurants. On camera, it's Satan's infomercial. You know, I just want to gouge my eyes out. I see that show.
Okay, now your show on the Food Network, mm-hmm. What's it about?
It's a totally cinema verite, unscripted, bumbling, staggering, and racing around the world, indulging myself, eating whatever comes my way, drinking the local beverage, making friends, and getting into horrible misadventures, with only the thinnest veneer of explanation and introduction. I think it's really fun, and it gives you a sense, I hope, of what it tastes like and smells like and feels like to walk down a back street in Tokyo or Saigon or Morocco.
Now, when you're doing this, of course, the cameras are shooting. When you maybe go to eat something or other things for that close-up, do you have to pretty much wait for the camera?
It was pretty good. I traveled with two people with two little digital cameras, no sound equipment. No, that was it. Total crew, two people. And a translator. Generally, they learned that there's no stunt food involved. I mean, they're shooting it as it happens. There are a couple of setups. For instance, if they miss me going into the restaurant, they'll ask me, could we shoot the entrance scene again? But it's pretty much cinema verite all the way. There are a few goofy stage things that we either had fun with just because we were bored and thought we'd have a good time, or because they needed to have some sense of continuity. But generally, those who are walk in the door again, please shots.
Okay. Now, you mentioned digital cameras.
Well, it's great because we were on some rickety, tiny little boats and back rivers, backwater of Cambodia. In some cases, they were shooting in minefields in a Khmer Rouge-controlled northwestern Cambodia. Does not do to be carrying one of those big over-the-shoulder beta cams in situations like that, where you have to literally be able to hide the camera, quickly as you run through roadblocks. I think it really made all the difference in the world traveling that light.
Of course, in the United States, maybe we take things for granted, the way that we can travel, and like you say, we can show the cameras, show things that we're doing. In other countries, it's not always that way.
No, people... particularly in Cambodia, there was a lot that we had to be very careful about. A lot of people carry guns there. You really don't know who's the army, who's the police, and who's just somebody with a Tweety Bird shirt and camo pants. In Morocco, also, there are folks who don't like having cameras pointed at them. And also, when you're shooting in a three-star kitchen, like Thomas Keller's The French Laundry, he doesn't want a crew in there with a big boom mic getting in his way in the middle of service. So we were able to capture a full 20-course meal at maybe the best restaurant in the United States because we were able to travel light. There was one shooter in the kitchen, two shooters outside of the kitchen. Most of them had experience shooting in E-rooms at trauma units, which is very useful when you're shooting with a Thomas Keller or a Gordon Ramsay who, don't like their space invaded, let's say.
So these cameras you're using, they're pretty much like the Steadicams?
No, just tiny little handheld digital cameras. And okay. They're wonderful. I think that the show looks really good.
Okay. Now, you've been around in a lot of countries, a lot of cities around the world. Where are some places maybe that you haven't been yet that you would like to go?
Well, I fell madly in love with Vietnam, and I'd like to go back. I wasn't in the north. I'd like to go to North Vietnam, the Central Highlands, Laos. Italy. I avoided some of the mama cuisines like France or Paris, Lyon, Italy, India, China, largely because I think some expertise is required when covering those subjects. But certainly I'd like to go there. I'd like to go back to Brazil and write about it, which is something I haven't done. It's a big, marvelous, sometimes scary, but always wonderful world. There are a lot of places I'd like to visit.
South Vietnam seemed to have had their share of moonshiners.
Oh, yeah. They make a rice moonshine in the Mekong Delta. And I did some drinking of that. They don't all toast all at once. They toast one at a time. So pretty much I had to individually do a shot with everybody in this enormous party of former Viet Cong. Yeah, I'm glad I made it out of that dinner with retaining verticality.
I was wondering if you were going to after reading some of that until you get to it.
So. It gets tricky. You know, a lot of these cultures, if you're going to make friends, you got to keep up. And certainly that's true in Russia, where you're not making any friends at all if you don't do shot for shot with these guys. So, yeah, there were I spent some lonely moments on cold bathroom floors during this during this adventure.
One of my favorite parts in the book, we're talking about, and apparently you're a smoker, which there's no secret about being in the book. You talk about the places where you can smoke in airports around the world.
Yeah. That's my idea of an enlightened culture. Hell, in Spain, I ate in Arzak, which is a 3-star Michelin restaurant, absolutely one of the best restaurants in Europe. I ate at the chef's table in the kitchen, and there were ashtrays on the table. I thought, now this is a culture.
This is where I want to end up here one of these days. Huh? You can catch Anthony on the Food Network. Kitchen Confidential. It was out maybe about a year ago or so. Great. It was a great successful book. It was on the bestseller list for many, 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 many weeks. It's now in paperback.
Mm-hmm.
It's number 10 as we're talking
Still ticking. It's in 15 languages now. I mean, I had no expectation when I wrote the book that it would travel even as far west as Philadelphia, much less that I'd be getting these calls from... I mean, it's going into Serbian, Hebrew, Korean. Apparently, cooks are the same all over the world.
So when you go into these places, whether they're kitchens or whether it's out in the country to eat a yak or something,
mm-hmm.
These people pretty much know who you are now.
No, in the English-speaking world, Germany, surely. But no one had any idea. I was just that really tall, skinny American dude with two cameras walking backwards in front of him.
Now, did they wonder why you had the cameras?
I think at first there was always an initial moment of suspicion or at least wonder. But more often than not, when people got the idea that I was there to eat, and that I was there to eat, you know, not just in really expensive sit-down restaurants, but I was there to eat local food, stall food, eat in markets, in people's homes and farms, and that I was not coming at the experience with any preconceptions. You know, I wasn't, you know, I was not put off by less than hygienic circumstances or, you know, squiggly or, you know, twitchy food, that I was there to eat and that I was going to give it everything I had and try to, you know, live it as they lived it and see it from the ground. And more often than not, people were very excited and wonderful about that, to see that someone cared, that someone was interested in their daily lives.
There's some reality shows on, Fear Factor comes mm-hmm. to mind, where they eat different types of foods. It sounds like you might be almost like a winner on that.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't, with the exception of the live beating cobra heart, which I did go after, well, just to satisfy myself, but clearly for shock value. I mean, I figured if things go terribly sour, with every part of my life, I can always catch a free drink off that story, right? So, other than that, though, I mean, I really wasn't looking to eat, you know, every scary bit of food on the planet. But that does come up now and again. You know, when you travel through the Southeast Asia and Mexico and North Africa, people do eat differently. And, you know, bugs are on, you know, you see bugs, fried bugs, in a lot of markets and a lot of places in the world. You know, I didn't go looking to freak everybody out.
So pretty much when you, because I've never eaten a fried bug.
No, they're delicious.
They are.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see them becoming the culinary delight on American foods?
You know, it's more of a snack food.
Plates?
You know, I could definitely see it as something, you know, do seventh inning stretch, you know, get a cone of, you know, fried crickets dredged in spices. Yeah, no reason why not.
And that may happen one day. Who knows?
Let's hope so.
Okay. What's up next for Anthony Bourdain?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to try to run away for a little while, spend some time eating all of my meals in bare feet with sand between my toes. And after that, I'm thinking of doing a sort of a military-style field manual, Strategy and Tactics of French Cuisine. I'm describing it as Julia Child meets Full Metal Jacket.
So another book. I mean, this one here is kind of light, in a sense. I mean, there was some funny parts in it, serious parts in it. Mm-hmm. Your next book also the same way.
Oh yeah, I mean, you'd be bad mistake to take me too seriously.
Okay. Now, how about any kind of a website?
I do. Oh my God, yes, there is AnthonyBourdain.com. I have a website. I got to visit that one of these days.
So you're not on it a lot, apparently, or do you?
Once I get back home, I'll be checking in with it because very nice people post things, and I try to answer them and try to keep up with it. I haven't been able to much lately, but okay. Hope to get back to it soon.
Now, your wife, I mean, does she get to go with you on these world tours?
Spain, Portugal, Russia, England, she went along with me. It's exhausting, and she thought this whole TV thing was a hideous mistake and found the cameras very annoying and doesn't know how I put up with it. I had concerns. I thought she was going to, punch out one of the camera people. if he said you're in the shot one more time, I thought it would, end in an assault beef. But, yeah, I think she's glad that the TV part of my career is over for now.
Okay. And, of course, how often are you on the Food Network?
It's every week, Tuesday nights, 10:30, I believe.
Okay, 10:30 at night. Mm-hmm. That would be Eastern time.
Yes.
Okay. And how long have you been on?
Started January 8th, I think.
Okay.
And it's a 22-part series, so, plenty more thrills, chills, and horrors to come.
Okay, so it's been a couple months now since you've been on.
Yeah.
What kind of feedback are you getting?
I'd say about 90% really, really positive, refreshing change. Thanks for keeping it real. 10% or so, I can't believe he's smoking on the Food Network. And does he have to curse? Because they beat me for language.
Do they?
Yeah. And some footage is pretty disturbing. And it is a kind of a manic depressive series. It's not fake. I'm not, smiling and pretending that I love everything and that you should, come and eat something that I frankly found terrible. So, of course, some people are disturbed by that, as well they should be.
Will we see anything like, maybe fried ants, maybe that you'll have to grab a handful and put them on maybe some ice cream and you'll go bam? I mean, that would be kind of funny.
Yeah, I need a catchphrase, We were thinking of when Tony gets hungry, something dies, but we thought maybe not.
Now, how about vegetarians? How are they taking this? I mean, there's an awful lot of death.
I've done everything possible to provoke them at every opportunity because I had the most awful meal of my life at the Real Heart of Darkness, Berkeley, where a bunch of vegans prepared a potluck meal for me. My only guess is that they just don't get enough protein to roll out of bed and come protest. It's like, I'd like to go say something at that jerk Tony, but I just feel so weak today.
talking about the vegans, they hate the thought of killing anything,
mm-hmm.
yet they're pretty much pro-abortion.
More to the point, I'm pro-abortion too, but, I don't like hurting little animals. I mean, I'm not Ted Nugent hurting little animals when our whole existence, privileged existence, is basically built on a heap of skulls. It just seems to me the front lines for this argument are not in Berkeley or in the States for that matter. And it just seems, an argument so filled with fear and contempt for other cultures inherent in the argument of veganism. I mean, some of these people are feeding their dogs vegetarian dinners, and that seems to me really to be cruelty to animals.
Yeah, no doubt. Should fatten those up and eat them.
Oh, never. Oh, poor little Fido, no way.
Okay, a cook's tour. I'm sure if you go to your website, you can catch maybe the first chapter of this book.
I think so, and certainly, yeah. I mean, there are various links. Amazon, there's a first chapter at Amazon.com, and I think there's a site at Food TV as well.
Okay. A cook's tour in search of the perfect meal, of course. It's just been out just a few weeks so far?
A few months.
A few months?
Yeah.
Okay, and how's it doing?
Doing very well.
What are people saying?
They're liking it. It's very much from the point of view of an enthusiast. I'm not a critic. I'm not an explainer. I'm just, a very lucky line cook who got to live his dream.
Okay, now, this is pretty much a cook's tour of the world. Do you ever see yourself making a cookbook one day?
No, not a traditional cookbook ever. That's just not. I was always kind of more interested, or at least as interested in the lifestyle of the cook, the subculture of cooking, the business, as I was in food, which explains my sort of checkered journeyman career, I think.
All right, Cook's Tour. It's a fun book, In Search of the Perfect Meal by Anthony Bourdain, also author of Kitchen Confidential, which has been going gangbusters in paperback. And also, you can catch Anthony on the Food Network. Again, that's
Tuesday nights, 10:30.
Tuesday evenings at 10:30. It's a show worth seeing. Stay up for that. Probably right after your local news anyway. So anyway, A Cook's Tour. It's a fun book. Anthony Bourdain, the author. Anthony, thank you.
My pleasure.
This has been Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Anthony Bourdain and his book, A Cook's Tour.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.